Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
Fear. Fear of fear. I hate being scared to do something. It's very simple. This is what I believe, and I'm willing to die for it. Yeah. Period. You can't be scared to die for the truth.
Good day, everyone. Welcome back to the show once again. It's Jazz here today doing the opening. My friend, good old friend, David is not here. He's a little bit busy. Since property market in Sydney is booming, he's been writing a lot of loans while John waits for Saturday to make more purchases. But he's here with me. And John, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Jazz, good to be here, mate. I can see you back in space.
I'm just grabbing all the gold while I'm here before the lockdown opens. So David is obviously a little bit busy, mate, with the property market. We saw obviously has taken a U-turn. The big action this week, John, my friend, has been the election debate that has been going on in the US. What are your thoughts on the debate that happened in the state?
Yeah, I watched it. Look, I mean, it was Wednesday morning our time. I was keen to watch it, and I don't know if the numbers have come out, but it was probably the most watched debate in history. I mean, it was highly anticipated. So what did I think? I thought it was an absolute mess. I thought it was a mess, and I think no one on stage came out looking very good. I think from the moderator, Chris Wallace, I think his name is, to Trump and Biden. If I had to, so here's kind of where I line up. And I think that Trump lost the debate, but I think he lost because all Biden needed to do was come out and prove that he's not a pot plant. There was a lot of concerns about whether Biden could do it, whether he could last an hour and a half, and whether he would. He's a kind of a gaffe machine, even from way back, right? So the fact that he was cogent, and I think Biden, the expectations for Biden were quite low. Trump interrupted way too much. It made him look like a petty bully. In a sense, that's what he is anyway. Mm-hmm. But if I had to crystallize it, I think I think Trump lost. I think Biden won on style, and I think Trump won on substance. But I think style matters more. And in on that basis, I think Trump lost and Biden won.
Mm-hmm. So do you see after this debate things changing a bit and people more inclining towards Biden and him winning the election? Or because last prediction that all three of us made on the podcast was Trump winning the election. Anything changed?
No, I still think Trump will win. If I look back, Ronald Reagan lost his first debate. Barack Obama lost the first debate to Mitt Romney really decisively. And so I think that incumbents typically lose debates. And when Reagan and Obama are far more articulate than Trump, and they still lost to their adversaries at the time. So I think that it will even out over the three. I think Trump needs to learn some lessons from the debate. So I still think Trump will win the election. And I think he'll win for a couple of reasons. One is I think he'll win on the economy, which I think matters a lot more than some of the other things. And I also think that there's some niggling nervousness about culture. And I think Trump will win on culture because I think when Americans stand back and look at their candidates, I think that despite Trump being an extremely flawed man, extremely flawed guy, that I think American voters look at Trump and say, well, at least he loves America. And I don't think you look at Biden and the Democratic Party at the moment and say, geez, they love America. And I think as an Australian citizen, I don't care either way, but as it's processed by American voters, who actually has affection for the country will matter. And I think in that respect, Trump wins. But, geez, I think the markets started pricing in a Biden win this week. That was the other thing that happened. There's a lot of volatility after the debate. And I think the markets are starting to price in a greater probability that Biden will win. I personally think Trump will win, but markets are smarter than I am.
So if so, we're still sticking with our guts. I still think Trump is going to win as well. So we're still sticking to our guts that Trump is going to win. Even though the market is pricing in Biden's win, from a assets perspective, nothing changes. We have discussed that as well in the past. If he's going to win, from the asset recovery is here, deflation debate will be gone.
Yeah, I think in the short term, the Biden win is slightly more bullish. I think it's more bullish for assets like gold and probably more bullish for the stock market. And I think the reason for that is that even though they're both making terrible mistakes in the wake of COVID, that I think that a Biden win will be slightly more inflationary. Mm-hmm. In the sense that, you know, there's the Democrat stimulus packages will be slightly bigger. But I only think that'll those market movements will prevail in the first 3 or 4 months of the election. I think if we fast forward a year, it won't matter. Mm-hmm. We're on the express train to currency debasement, and I think that neither party can stop that now.
The big thing is the currency debasement, which always takes you back to the business of gold, silver, and other speculative assets, basically. Yep. So that's interesting. It's fair to say, looking at all the stats that we have seen come out this week as well, that the property market has really turned here, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, so CoreLogic released their data, and it's more important the data that comes out now, because we're at the end of a quarter or at the end of a month, and we can start to digest that information and see where we're at. There was a Sydney Morning Herald headline today that said, housing bears face extinction as forecasts turn bullish. Mm-hmm. And that's a real theme, that this is not as bad as we thought. Mm-hmm. So your and my view on this is slightly more nuanced than prices go up, you know, good, bad. We're saying that there is a depression. It's just an inflationary depression where currency destruction is leading to a melt-up. Mm-hmm. We're not saying that any of this is good, that the property market's going up is good. We're just saying that that's what's going to happen when you overprint money and you destroy the currency. But I kind of think, you know, you look at the mainstream economists, I don't think they got it right. And I think that they look at bad economy equals falling prices. And it's not always the case, because bad economies lead to interventions from central banks and governments. And those interventions from central banks and governments have consequences. Mm-hmm. And the melt-up is a consequence of the response to COVID, not to COVID itself. Mm-hmm. So property went down by Sydney went down by 0.3%. But if you look across the country, only Sydney and Melbourne were the only cities to go down in the last month. So mm-hmm. all the other capitals are growing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'll find that by next month, Sydney will be growing as well, which leaves the property market languishing in Victoria only, which means one out of the six capital cities is falling, and all the other cities are rising in prices. So this was not what most people thought was going to happen. Everyone thought this was going to be a devastating multi-year decline, and here we are in what are almost boom conditions.
Mm-hmm. And that's not to bash the economist at all, that they get their predictions wrong. I think a lot of the things that economists take into the account were more from an economy sort of correlated to the assets. But the reality is, and we've discussed that on this podcast a lot, is that they're not actually completely, it looks like, inversely correlated to some extent. The worse the economy does, the better the asset prices. So the case that economists have put forward, especially when with the mortgage suspensions and all the other stuff, was a very valid case. But mm-hmm. I think it's just that the two things are completely separate. Even though we are in a bit of a mess overall with the system, but it's all still better for the property market. So you've got to preserve your wealth one way or the other, and this is the way you can preserve your wealth, essentially, is the point. Or one way that you can preserve your wealth outside of other asset classes.
Yeah, I think most modern economists think in terms of aggregate demand, that Keynesian formula of consumption plus government spending plus, well, you know, that's not really how the economy works. The economy doesn't work in terms of aggregates. It works in terms of micro decision making. So mm-hmm. you can have aggregate demand falling and property prices going up. It's just aggregate demand is not the right way to look at the economy because it's too too aggregated. You got to look at micro decision making, and that's how you figure out what's going to happen.
Yeah, especially with the chart that you were just looking at before, where it clearly tells you over there, Sydney, Melbourne were -1.6 and -3.3%, mm-hmm. Whereas Brisbane was 0% for the quarter, Adelaide 0.9%, Perth was -0.3%. So that tells you it is markets within the markets. And this is still talking at the state level. If you drill down to the micro burbs, then it will change the story altogether.
That's right. And that's just geography. So that's just city by city, state by state. Then if you say, okay, houses versus units, units are down, houses are up, and there's lots of ways to slice and dice. But, yeah. You know, these are all, I mean, when we think about it, you know, the COVID hit in February, March, that was only 6 months ago. No investor should be, particularly in real estate, which is not very liquid. I mean, we shouldn't be jumping at shadows and dramatically changing your strategy. I think you can, if you're a capital city investor and you own solid real estate, you just have to kind of suck it up and march through it.
Exactly. We discussed last week on the podcast about the how Australian PMI Purchase Manufacturing Index had really seen that V-shaped recovery. And for this month, I had the China's composite PMI on us, and it's the same thing that China is, it's showing us a recovery at a full scale to some extent.
I know what you're saying. You're sort of saying that if China kind of went into COVID earlier and came out of COVID earlier, and their numbers are pretty strong, can we expect that in places like the US and Australia? And I think the answer to that is yes. The only kind of issue I have with the V-shaped recovery story is that if we take airlines, for example, let's say airline travel declines by 90%, which it did in that time period, and then let's say airline activity goes up by 50% from there, well, it still means that airline activity is still down 85% from the peak. So we're miles away from, 2019 levels. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem I have with celebrating the growth after the dip. The growth after the dip, it's going to take years to get to 2019 levels. And we're looking at PMI with 55%, which is still growth over a collapse in March.
Exactly. So who do you think post-COVID world will be the major winner, US or China?
That's a good question. So that's in fact that might be the question, right? The correct question for the next decade. So I think it's complicated, and I'm probably going to be wrong on this, but I think that China will emerge better for two reasons. One is that part of what's propping the US up is the reserve currency status, and I think that's going to be problematic over the next decade. Mm-hmm. So I think the US, in a sense, has further to fall. That's reason number one. The currency is probably going to move adverse to the US. The second reason is that whenever you have a sort of an economic war or a cold war, the country with the production wins. So the US was able to outproduce Russia in the Cold War. It was more productive and so on. And I just think the country with the factories wins. Mm-hmm. In this case, the country with the factories is China. Mm-hmm. Now, I could totally be wrong because China has a lot of problems. It's one thing having all the factories, but if you're building all the wrong things like ghost towns or something like that, mm-hmm. then rather than being productive, you're squandering all these resources and squandering all this wealth. So China has a lot of problems. China does a lot of things wrong. Mm-hmm. But if I had to guess who emerges in a slightly stronger position over the next 5 years, I would say China. What do you reckon?
I think you pretty much nailed it. So there's a productivity story over there, which is the manufacturing. But also, US so far has been advanced in the tech space. So when we look at some of that stuff now, China seems to be progressing pretty fast in the 5G space. So that's one. And second is the AI story. So China is becoming more from a copycat to an innovator now, so which is what US used to be. And when you feed the productivity story, which is the manufacturing units and the technology together, I think China comes out to be the winner. Where they're suffering, and you already mentioned that to some extent, is the currency part. There's a bigger picture here with the currency of what's going to happen to the currency and what the future reserve currency is going to look like.
I mean, the interesting thing is also that we're talking as though this is a bipolar world, and in some respects that's true, but we're ignoring two other powerhouses or emerging powerhouses. We're talking about geopolitics, and we're not talking about Europe, which is a problem, and it reflects it's not irrelevance, but it's the kind of the problems that Europe has being relevant in terms of geopolitics without a military and all that sort of stuff. So Europe is deeply problematic. And the fact that they punch way below their weight on all these sorts of things is an issue. So here we are talking about a bipolar world and not talking about Europe. The other country is India.
Mm-hmm.
India is, you know, they've had scuffles with China recently, but they would be firmly in the pro-US camp. But mm-hmm. they're also a powerhouse as well, or at least an emerging powerhouse.
Yeah. We do have a special guest today on the show from Perth. There's a lot happening in the Perth property market as well. There's a population boom and there's a resource sector that's starting to kick into gear. So we have got David Hall on the show today to give us a quick update on the property market.
Okay, guys. So the Perth market came off the bottom about 18 months ago. But the uptick has been very, very slow. Since COVID, and in particular since West Australia finished its lockdown, the market has gone crazy. We are already in an incredibly tight rental market. We're almost at historic lows of the number of properties available for rent. Currently, we're sitting at 2,900 properties available for rent. And the lowest ever was 2,500. Given the current rate of rental absorption and the pretty much absence of investors in the market, come February, we'll have less than 1,500 properties available for rent, and that is going to be a genuine rental crisis. On top of that, we layer the fact that Perth is ridiculously cheap. So, for example, 4 weeks ago, I purchased a house in a suburb called Burswood, seven houses back from the start of the CBD, a little 3-1 villa, 12 in a complex of four of 1,200 square metres, $360,000. Ridiculously cheap. So what we're seeing is the rental market is putting a huge impost on rents. Rents are climbing rapidly. Our property in Tuart Hill last leased for $420 a week. We've just re-leased it for $425 a week. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it is half the price to buy a house versus pay the rent. With rents increasing rapidly, and it's already starting, we're seeing a large movement of first-time owners into the market. We've got a state budget, which I'm pretty sure is the following week, and the rumour mill is suggesting that there's going to be a $7,000 grant for first-time buyers for existing properties. Mm-hmm. And just things that we're seeing in the market. So Perth sellers sell in spring, buyers buy in January. It's really weird. So we should have had a jump of between 800 to 1,200 listings over the last 3 weeks because as more stock comes on for the spring listing period, we've dropped 300. Anything that is of an owner-occupier quality that is well-priced, well-presented, is getting multiple offers first, second week. It's getting seriously competitive, and I'm seeing really strong price growth occurring. So, for example, got a client wanting to buy in a suburb called Sorrento. Can't find the house they want, so we're going to build it. 6 months ago, I could have bought a basic 1980s 3-1 for $650,000, pushed it over, and we could have built the new home on it. Mm-hmm. Today, I can't find anything to buy for under $850,000. That's a six-month movement. Mm-hmm. It's we will have a two-speed market. So we've got some very generous state, federal grants, you know, up to $55,000 for a new build. There's nothing in CBD. I mean, if you were to jump on realestate.com.au, type in Craigie as a suburb, exclude all the houses that are under offer, and just basically type in for lots of 600 square meters, you'll find that there's two properties for sale.
What about the jobs data? How is that tying up into this?
Yeah, well, so we've got the highest number of vacant jobs in 12 years. It was advertised in today's paper. So West Australia is booming.
David, that was a great rundown. I just wanted to ask one very simple question, which is why? Yeah. What's happening?
Two reasons.
Macro, because the economy in Perth is sort of centered around resources. Is this a kind of a harbinger for a resources boom that's just starting up, or what's happening? Why the population growth? Why the real estate boom?
So there's going to be two factors behind it. The first factor is what I'm calling COVID refugees. So up until recently, we've had 525 people a week coming into Western Australia from overseas, plus migration, because the mining companies, we used to have a lot of eastern states working for us. Because of the border restrictions, we've had mining employees who used to be FIFO from, say, Port Hedland to Victoria, now being told you can either have no job or you can reside in Perth. Don't know what the numbers for the mining are, but Perth has an average population density of 2.3 people per house. We've had 525 people a week coming in. So you would comfortably say there's at least 200 houses a week that are needing, they're either going to be bought or rented. Go back to the GFC. Perth did exceptionally well out of the GFC because governments globally said, what can we do to stimulate our economies? Let's build infrastructure. So for Perth, that means copper, gold, iron ore, nickel, lithium. It means all of those products. So we're going to have another construction boom. And I don't think it's going to start for 2 years in earnest, mm-hmm. but already we can't get engineers. Mm-hmm. We can't get mechanics. It's going to start ramping up in around 2 years to meet the global demand for steel and for all the other ingredients that go into infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But that will be the second wave.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, there's usually two phases to a commodities boom that leads to a real estate boom in Perth. There's the initial part where they're prospecting for the metals, they're building the roads to go to the mines, they're building the infrastructure that facilitates the mining. And that's when the real estate boom is, because that's really labor intensive. And then the second part is when if you like the straw is already in the drink and they just need to suck the mines out. And that's not very labor intensive, and that's when you see the real estate market come down. So, what's your time frame on the property market cycle in Perth? Is it
it's starting now? Yeah. I believe we'll have probably a very strong rise over the next 4 years. It might go to five, and then the bubble will burst. Perth is very much a boom and bust town. It doesn't have the flat consistency of Melbourne or Sydney, but it is, you've got to go to an open home here to just see how busy it is. The real turn is, so the problem is it takes around 15 years from when you find a deposit to when you start construction because of government regulation. A project I was working on many years ago, 600 Ks from the nearest sealed road, the government wanted us to build two-storey dongas because they were worried about sand dunes. So it's a 13-year from, we've found something to let's start building it. So what they're doing is they're not actually building new mines, they're constructing and doing expansions. So when you look at the gold sector, what they're doing is they're increasing throughput capacity, they're mining lower grade. When we look at the iron ore sector, like Gina's just announced, she's doing another $400 million expansion on another iron ore project to increase capacity. So it's going to be, initially it's going to be a story of increasing capacity because of the time frame that it takes to get mines built. But we have three major iron ore mines currently about to hit the ground under construction.
So, David, no one's got a crystal ball, but if you were to pick a number in the next, 3 to 5 years, you can put a time frame, right? Where do you see the Perth market and what's up?
I'm hopelessly optimistic. I believe that December next year, Perth will have punched 15%. The demand is just so strong. And I can see over the four-year period, we may go, I will certainly do 50%, we may do 60%. And it's going to be led by a rental market, because there is, come February, there will be nothing to rent. Mark McGowan is scaring investors off by doing a second extension of the COVID policy. That's keeping investors out, because who knows if there's going to be a third extension or not.
Yeah, I agree. So we both sort of follow the commodities markets, and we have our separate commodity show. So that Perth is booming is really interesting, and I don't doubt it. I'm actually surprised it started already, though. Yeah. I'm surprised that it's already happening. The reason for that is, if indeed, you know, that Labor needs to get into Perth, I don't know how they're getting there. I mean, borders are shut and airlines are closing down. So I don't know how anywhere can have an interstate population boom, but the data does suggest that that's what's happening. So my kind of view is that commodities, this is a good decade for commodities. I'd say it starts with precious metals, and then it moves on in the next couple of years to broader industrial metals. So, you know, you buy your Newcrest now and you buy your BHP later, that sort of thing. So we'll see. But if Perth is booming, it does tie into resources, and it's a very fascinating story. And it actually, just add a footnote, it ties into what's happening in Brisbane as well, because Brisbane's doing quite well at the moment, and that's a secondary resource state.
The purpose of that was basically to tie it all together, that there's a resource story going on, which is the gold and silver and other precious metals. And then obviously is the Perth property market, along with Brisbane, like what John mentioned just before. They all tie in together to some extent. Again, you have to be selective on the suburbs and all, but that story that's coming out is really good.
I like the way you ended last week, Jazz, which was with, you know, predictions. I almost think we should always do that. What do you think? Because, I mean, obviously we're always going to be wrong, but it's fun to think about it. I think the shocking news for 2021 might be 2022, but I would say look at Hong Kong breaking its US dollar peg, maybe next year, maybe the year after. Yeah. And I don't want to say that I'm being completely original. I was listening to a Brent Johnson podcast, and he was saying that that's his big macro
bet,
asymmetric trade for the next year or two, that he says, watch the Hong Kong dollar break away from the US dollar, because the US dollar is too strong. And if you have a peg, it's too strong for Hong Kong, inflating assets and so on. So that's an interesting thing. I think he's right. Watch the Hong Kong dollar over the next couple of years.
There's a lot of advertisement happening on the buses in Hong Kong with "be your own bank," and then it says Bitcoin. So... I don't know what that means. It's just fascinating that you mentioned that the peg is being broken, and then there's a lot of advertisement happening around Bitcoin. I don't know who's doing it, because Bitcoin is a decentralized network. Obviously, the big bag holders, I'm assuming, are trying to promote it. But the fact that it's running on the buses in Hong Kong and in the US tells you that there's more to it.
Well, you know, what's also interesting is that, you know, when the Asian currency crisis happened in 1997, most people think the trigger for that, I'm sure it's true as well, was that the Thai baht collapsed. But actually, it happened the week after the vote for the handback of Hong Kong to China. So Someone like Kyle Bass would say, actually, the Asian currency crisis occurred because China flexed its muscles and was getting Hong Kong back. So that's interesting too.
Mm-hmm.
Watch that space.
What do you think is... What's your gold prediction for 2021? Where do you see gold ending 2021 with?
I would say, predictions are dangerous. I would say next year will be big for gold. I actually think that gold settles for the rest of this year. It stays around 1900, maybe 2000. And I think next year it goes to 2,500, but it could go to 3,000. It could be a big year. I kind of see gold doing 30% every year for the next 5 years or so.
30% every year for the next five years?
30% every year, yep. Jet, what's your 2021 prediction?
Fed's balance sheet.
You did.
It will double by end of 2021. Do you see the Fed balance sheet doubling end of next year?
No, I don't see it happening that quickly. I see another stimulus package, which they're negotiating at the moment. That's $2.5 trillion. Mm, geez, it might.
That's already 25%.
Yeah. I think it goes up by like 50% a year, which is staggering, but it's not 100%.
Then surely your prediction on the gold, I think, is going to be pretty accurate, that it will see somewhere between 25 to 3K US next year.
Well, see, timing's always the hard thing. These predictions are difficult to get the timing right, but I think that, you know, the meta story, the broad themes are right, like, you know, high gold prices, high real estate, yeah. But just by when, it's impossible to answer.
It can drop from here by 10 to 15%. That won't be a surprise. But the overall picture is looking positive. And if it does 30% year on year for the next while, that's pretty cool.
Here's another meaningless prediction. I think that the Q4 numbers will disappoint, and that we might have another steep market correction in January, February next year when expectations don't meet. So another Wall Street crash in Q1 next year.
Let's define crash. When you say crash, do you mean a 40% drop like what we saw in March of this year, or do you mean a lower correction type of thing?
I mean something like 20%.
20%.
Yeah, something like that.
Great chat, mate. A lot happening in the property space, mainly property stories this week, but that's good. We are in the property game, so we like that.
I can't wait for next week.
We'll see you guys next week. Jazz and John.